All right. Decisions. And damn, we got a lot more decisions today than we did, maybe over the last year. Just thinking about what's going on here, what's going on everywhere. And I just have to say that before we get started, I mean, we have a packed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with actors Rob Nagel and Tanya Alexander from the play Human Interest Story, now playing because no small theater is, or even medium-sized theater is playing right now. They've basically been told that they got to shut their doors, turn off the lights, and hang around and go someplace else and wait for things to change. But this is the kind of thing that's happening right now. And I wanted to say something before we go on, all right? Well, maybe what I should say is who the rest of my guests are. Before we have the folks from the Fountain Theater, and we're going to be talking with them about all that's been going on in relation to this, and I think it's going to be fairly cool. We're also, in the middle of the show, we're going to be talking with Carol Jaffe and David S. Cohen, authors of the book Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. And these folks, I interviewed them a while back. Very, very interesting, very important that what they've done with this book. And I found the book to be a remarkable piece of work, all right? And I think it's something that people really need to pay attention to, especially these days. And before that, opening the show up, we're going to be talking with Atlas Winfrey from the Los Angeles Revolution Club about the latest developments in the case of the Freeway 9. And we're going to get into that in just 1 minute, all right? Because I do have to say this. Sisters and brothers, if you're looking around and you're thinking about what's happening on, people should be careful. But don't go crazy, okay? Because, you know, I was reading some stuff today, and I don't know what. My eyes are still burning because somebody started talking about somewhere about we got to go after the Asians, we got to go after the black people, we got to go after the immigrants, that all these kinds of things that they're to blame for what the hell this system and what this system is doing to people, what's happening now in terms of the climate, all this other stuff, what's happening in terms of this disease that's sweeping over the world. And, you know, it's just the right kind of climate. You can see that some Nazi half-ass like Donald Trump is going to get out and pull this up and start blaming people of color, blaming people who aren't the same as him. You know, and think about what has been unleashed in the past and what could possibly be unleashed against people now. And we cannot allow that to happen. We got to be smart. We got to be careful. We got to work with each other. We got to figure it out, you know, basically what's happening and what we're going to do. But we are not, and it is not a cool thing to go out and start talking about you're going to take down some immigrants, you're going to take down some Chinese people, you're going to take down some black people. Because after all, everybody knows white people don't have any problems. They don't ever cause any problems. Well, nobody's causing this problem except this system in terms of how people cannot, you know, think about what a difference it would make to be living in a society where what's going on now would be recognized to whatever extent it could be. It could be recognized at any given time, but that people will be learning to work with each other to deal with all this. We'll be learning to help each other. We'll be learning to kind of, you know, not just like look for number one. I mean, I'll tell you what. I went to the grocery store the other day, and I wasn't even going to get, you know, any kind of water or anything else. I was just walking around. And I thought, well, I'm going to take a look and see what's up over here. I wanted to get something to clean up. You know, I was going for that thing, which is important. You should have stuff to clean up. I think it's very important. But, you know, I'm looking at that, and all of a sudden I look down the aisles, and every little piece of this thing is empty. It was like you could set up a fan and blow like tumbleweeds through the place. You know, this is the kind of thing that I think we really have to pay attention to. We have to pay attention to how we work with each other, how we you know, handle this, what we're actually trying to do, and come out of it. All right, so that's all I'm going to say on that. But right now, I want to welcome to the show Atlas Winfrey from the Los Angeles Revolution Club. Atlas, how are you?
Doing well, Michael. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure, you're doing well, huh? I'll see about that. Well, listen, man, one of the reasons I really wanted to have you on, aside from your, you know, great personality, is this. You know, there has been listeners to the show know, you know, a while back we did a whole series on and followed what was happening with the LA Revolution Club and the fact that people were up against some serious charges. The system was actually doing all kinds of, you know, screwed up stuff to try and get at them. And eventually the system was pushed back. But now you find out just a little while ago, they're coming back full force and even more than full force. And I wanted you to sort of give people some background and then talk about what's happening now.
Okay, yeah. So the Freeway 9, this trial is about a group of heroic and courageous protesters who blocked the 101 freeway in Los Angeles in 2017 with a 50-foot banner that said, Trump, Pence must go. And this was a part of sounding the alarm against a rapidly advancing fascism. This was before we had the concentration camps. You know, this is before we've seen all these Supreme Court rulings go through that say that LGBTQ people can be discriminated against, stripping away the ability of immigrants all over the world to be able to apply for asylum. You know, this was back then, and people understood that all these crimes, all these horrors that are happening, these aren't coming from anywhere. This isn't just the incompetency of the Trump-Pence regime, but that this is a part of a rapidly consolidating fascism. And they understood that what that would mean for people, what that would mean for people not just in this country, but all over the world, is horrors on an untold level that we have not seen before. I mean, this is an American fascism with somebody who's talking about dropping nuclear bombs on the rest of the world. And so they acted with extraordinary moral courage to wake people up. There's so many people who have come to become well-adjusted to the crimes that are being perpetrated every day, to try to wake them up to actually see this for what it is and to act in line with this kind of morality that the whole world comes first, not American lives. And so now we're on trial. The Democratic city attorney filed 57 charges against 11 people targeting both refused fascism activists and the Revolution Club. And we found out through the course of this trial that the LAPD anti-terrorist division sent in a confidential informant into meetings to secretly record what was going on. But also very recently it came to light that he had attempted multiple times to entrap members of refused fascism, openly inciting violence in meetings. And this is something that is not allowed. The LAPD's own rules prohibit them from using their informants as agent provocateurs, and they violated all of this to go after these heroic people. That's some background. And now two of the defendants are currently on trial. They've been going through this process. They just testified yesterday. Today, as we speak, they're going to be hearing closing arguments. And then the jury is going to go to deliberate. But then for the remaining defendants, their trial will begin either next week or perhaps after. We don't know, given the crisis we're all confronting right now.
Let me ask you this, because one of the things that's extraordinary about what's happened with the, you know, with this case, and in particular right now with the two people that you were just talking about, Alex and Chantel, you know, last year they ended with a jury deadlocked 9-3 for acquittal. And this happened after the defense brought out why they blocked the freeway and why the jury and everyone else should support this. And the thing was exactly what you're saying, because Trump is a fascist who is actually trying to consolidate fascism right now. You know, so you look at this and this whole thing about when I was sitting in the courtroom the other day, you know, I was watching it. And I was thinking, you know, there's something very heavy here because the weight of illicit authority is pretty heavy, you know, and the way that they kept pushing this out and the fact that they, you know, that the thing was over, it was beaten before, and they've come back, and they have a lot that they seem that they're pushing a lot harder on us. And I think it's really important that people understand that there is prosecution and persecution of the Revolution Club and refused fascism that's really intense right now. Let's talk about that.
Right. Well, what's going on here is it's actually an attempt from the LAPD and the Democratic city attorney, Mike Feuer, to determine what will and what won't be allowed in protest against the Trump-Pence fascist regime. The whole mission of what Refuse Fascism was setting out to do was to stop the consolidation of fascism, calling millions of people into the streets in mass, sustained, nonviolent political protest to force the removal of Trump and Pence and their whole cabinet, their whole administration. And the Los Angeles political and police authorities, they would much rather acquiesce to a fascist regime in power than to allow the mass nonviolent protest movement that is, you know, uncompromising in demanding that the whole regime must go. And through this process, they actually targeted Refuse Fascism as a terrorist group. they violated the First Amendment rights of the people, you know, by sending in this confidential informant. That puts a chill, actually, on people dissenting against the crimes of their government. And they went so far as, inside the trial itself, to try to get the judge. This is the Democratic city attorney who tried to get the judge to ban any kind of mention of outside politics. The motion filed by Mike Feuer's office included trying to ban the words Trump, fascism, immigration, social injustices, where if the defense or their lawyers said any of those words, they could be arrested. They could be held in contempt of court and prosecuted. This is how worried they were about the actual politics of the case coming into it, because there's big stakes involved with this. The first thing is, it's completely legal what they did. Protest and dissent involves disruption to society, and that means that people will be personally inconvenienced. And that's something we tolerate because we think it's important that we have a society where there's dissent, critical thinking, protest, you know, a way to try to work together to stop the crimes of our government. And, you know, it was also necessary. This is a situation we're in right now. You know, people are very concerned about themselves, you know, getting coronavirus. But just think about what's going to happen in these concentration camps where immigrants are denied basic hygiene products, where they're stuffed like sardines, denied soap, don't have access to clean water. You know, there's going to be unnecessary death and suffering because of the xenophobia, the racism, the science denying of this fascist regime. And this is what we were setting out to stop. And what does it say about the LAPD? What does it say about the city attorney's office that they are so determined, that they have such an animus to stop Refuse Fascism and the revolutionaries from actually being able to stop this nightmare, from getting this beast off the back of the people of the world, this fascist regime? This is something that we all have to confront. All of us who, you know, all of the people out there that are just sitting back and leaving this to the politicians, you know, just sitting back and hoping that somebody else is going to take care of this crisis for us while more and more people unnecessarily suffer.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have one more question, but first I have to say this is the Michael Slate Show. And so stay tuned and keep your ears open. And we're talking with Atlas about what the hell is happening with the city government going after people who dared to stand up and say, no, we won't allow this system to operate the way and kill and torture people in 1,000 different ways, that we actually are standing up and saying this is not acceptable. So, Atlas, tell me this. You know, one of the things that keeps coming on, and I, you know, it's actually, you know, I keep thinking about, okay, that Mike Feuer, you know, Feuer, I'm not trying to be silly, but there's actually something concentrated in the whole way that these people approach things in his name, you know, because, I mean, the stuff that's going on is really fascistic when you think about this and the way that they're plowing through this. And, you know, there's a thing where, you know, there's certain things, there's people cannot just sit back and let this, you know, just sort of roll over us, you know. And so I wanted to hear what actually, you know, you're thinking of, what people are thinking about in terms of what people should be doing now in response to this, because it's there's a reality. If you let this one roll, the other one's going to be 10 times bigger and a lot more, you know, elements to it. So this is kind of, it is when they said this, when they brought on this stuff around the, you know, about the people and bringing up all these, you know, prosecutions or persecutions of the Revolution Club, you know, that was really intense. And the fact that they did plant this snitch, you know, and it was in Refuse Fascism meetings in a church, no less, you know, and think about and what that snitch was trying to get people to do, you know, the kind of setup that was going on. So let's talk about what actually is going on now, what people should be doing in the face of this.
Well, it's important to realize that the LAPD anti-terrorist division is targeting nonviolent protest against this regime as terrorism. They're sending in spies. They're entrapping people. You know, this spy in an open meeting talking about where people were discussing white supremacists, you know, this was said in open court by the lawyers, that this informant said, quote, "You can give me a gun any day, I'll shoot them," end quote. And this was disavowed by members of the organization, but this wasn't the only attempt that he made. He made several attempts. And if this is allowed to slide, we are accepting, right, that the LAPD and the city government can target anybody, any kind of nonviolent protest as terrorism, harass, spy, prosecute people. And this is especially dangerous in a time where a fascist regime is at the helm. You know, it is Trump that's saying, you know, that has open disregard for dissent, that says, you know, that he longs for the days when protests were carried out on stretchers, who himself is looking into making anti-fascist protest into a terrorist designation. This is something that we just cannot accept. And it has big stakes, not just for other protest groups who should oppose this because of the way that it will put a chill on all protest and dissent, but too, because we really do have to force this regime out of power. And if we're allowing the city government to suppress, to put people in jail who are fighting for that kind of understanding, fighting to remove this fascist regime, then that's going to mean huge consequences for humanity. That's going to mean nightmares for people, not just in this country, but all over the world.
Okay, Atlas, we're going to have to wrap this up now, but I want to thank you very much for joining us, and we'll stay in touch, all right?
Thanks.
And how should people find out more about it as they go along?
You should go to refusefascism.org. This second trial is about to begin. You can get information there and information, regular updates about how you can carve into this, how you can defend the Freeway 9, and how we can actually use this as political jujitsu, how we can make this the proverbial rock that they drop on their own feet and actually use this to advance the struggle of opposition against the crimes of our government and to remove this whole regime.
All right, Atlas, thank you very much, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Atlas from, and actually, you know what? We've just been talking with Atlas from the Los Angeles Revolution Club about the latest developments in the case of the Freeway 9. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. All right, Teddy, now you know, that's the kind of music that I listen to when nobody else is hearing me, okay, or seeing me, all right? All right, there it goes. All right. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and our next guests are going to, I don't know if either one of them remembers this, but I interviewed them a long time ago when I was much younger, okay? And I always found them just indispensable in terms of understanding what the hell is going on, particularly in relation to the assault on abortion and the need to actually for people to fight for the right to abortion. And just recently, I came across a new book that's called, relatively new now, but it's called Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. And it's written by David S. Cohen and Carol Jaffe. And I want to welcome them both. David is a law professor at Drexel University and co-author of Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. And Carol Jaffe is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology and reproductive sciences at the University of California in San Francisco and co-author of Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. Well, both of you. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having us.
Sure. Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Good to hear you guys' voice, you know. And I have to tell you, every time I see your name, and I think of Drexel University, and of course, I wasn't going to university out there. I was more or less going around and terrorizing the streets in the neighborhood when I was back there. But that's where I came up. Okay, so Philly's a hard place. So
yes.
Yeah. Anyway, let's jump into this right away, because to me, this is an extremely important thing, and it intersects with so much of what we were just talking with our last guest about. And overall, in terms of what's happening in the world right now, there's the turbulent state of abortion in America today. You know, people, and I think a lot of people, including people my age, we came up out of the 60s, and for a lot of times, you know, you might hear things about what's happening around abortion, there's a threat here, there's a threat there, but I don't think a lot of people have fixed in their mind just how heinous this assault is and how real it is and how hard it is to actually deal with this. So why don't we talk with that? I don't know, which one of you would like to speak first?
Okay. So I'll jump in here, and I think that one of the things that, you know, our book really highlights is that even without Roe v. Wade being overturned, abortion access is really difficult in this country already for significant numbers of people, particularly poor people, particularly women of color, and people who live in rural areas. There are so many obstacles that states have put in the way of someone accessing an abortion that, you know, it's not illegal, but it might as well be for a lot of people because it's almost impossible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if I could just, Michael, if
absolutely.
I could add to that, my colleagues at the University of California, San Francisco, did a study, and they found out that it is so difficult for women to put together all the pieces necessary to get to an abortion clinic, finding the money, finding childcare, because 60% of people getting abortions are already parents, getting the transportation, which is a huge obstacle for very poor women. The study showed that about 4,000 women a year are turned away from clinics because by the time they get there, they're too late in pregnancy for that clinic's capacity to deal with them.
Mm, boy. Well, let's dig into this a little bit deeper because we're talking about already in a post-Roe v. Wade world, you know, you have a minefield for women, as you're just talking about, who need and want an abortion. What are some of the concrete expressions of how this happens? I mean, because it's one thing, you know, I'm reading your book and, you know, it's just you find yourself getting intensely angry. You find yourself really, you know, sort of like, what? They can't do that. But actually, everything is behind them. They do it, you know, and they have the laws and everything else to back them up. So I'd like people to know what is this? We're talking about a minefield for women who need and want an abortion. And what are some of the concrete expressions of this?
David, you start. Yeah, I'll start and then Carol can jump in. So I think the number one obstacle, I think, is that Medicaid doesn't cover abortion, which means for poor women in this country, and in terms of the abortion population, 50% of women who have an abortion are at or below the poverty line, and another quarter of women are at 200% of the poverty line, or between 100 and 200%. So we're talking about 75% of abortion patients being low income or poor. But Medicaid doesn't cover abortion. So that means that they have to make the choice that Medicaid was put in place to stop. They have to choose between paying for food, shelter, childcare, clothes, electricity, or getting an abortion. And that's exactly why we have Medicaid in this country, to try and avoid that choice for poor people. And it's far from perfect, obviously, but for abortion patients, it's even worse because it's just not allowed to be covered. So that means that they really struggle. So I think that, you know, the people we talked to for our book just told us repeatedly how difficult that makes it for a lot of women in this country.
Mm-hmm. And just to inform your listeners who may not be aware, the average price of a first trimester abortion is about somewhere between $550, $600. In some places, it's more. But the later you go in pregnancy, the more expensive it gets. And so we've been told of a very vicious cycle. A woman finds out she's pregnant. By the time she gets all the pieces in place, it's very often she just gets there too late for a first trimester, which is, in fact, relatively speaking, cheaper than a later one.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, here's the thing. You know, it's also true, and I keep thinking about this because, you know, having grown up in a time when actually all kinds of free thinking broke loose, where all kinds of things, it didn't last, and it wasn't as deep as it needed to be, but there was a remarkable, wonderful breaking out of the chains that women were being held in, a breaking of those chains to a certain extent. And the first time, in history in this country, that women and men were actually talking about, but women in particular, were talking very freely about the right to have an abortion. You know, where women could actually, you know, they didn't have to, you know, if they went out and they, you know, whatever, they had a boyfriend, they met somebody, whatever. One thing led to another, and suddenly the woman finds herself she's pregnant, and she decides, you know, in the old times, okay, and they're unfortunately not so old because it's the kind of thing that they're trying to do today, just go into the back room and wait for the baby to drop, you know, and give up your life and everything else, and you live with what you dealt yourself, you know, and that's sort of a thing that was kind of rolled over in the 60s, but then we see not rolled over hard enough, not rolled over deep enough, and actually it still comes out today. So let's talk about that a little, because that's really something, you know, that I don't think people get, that this is not just a, you know, look, there's a lot of roadblocks that are facing women who want an abortion today. It's not that easy to walk around and say, I want an abortion, help me out, you know?
Yeah, David, if it's okay with you, let me first respond, because Michael, I think we're more or less in the same demographic. And I do remember those days. I do remember the days of the 60s and the early 70s when all kinds of political and cultural things were happening, including people, both men and women, but especially women, very assertively saying, we have the right to be sexual, we have the right to have an abortion and birth control. And by the way, child care, those arguably were among the biggest demands of second wave feminism. But what, and you're asking what happened? Well, one way to understand the backlash is that after Roe v. Wade in 1973, I think it's fair to say the pro-choice movement basically became complacent. They thought it was settled. However, the anti-abortion movement grew very strong, very powerful, initially had the resources of the Catholic Church, later joined by evangelicals. And so since Roe, we've had almost 50 years of opposition to abortion at every level, legislative, but also cultural. The anti-abortion movement has been very, very effective in stigmatizing abortion. And you're right. I mean, we see some pushback now from younger activists, which is very encouraging. But in general, the 50 to 60 million women or so who've had abortions do not go around saying I've had an abortion. I mean, there's too much stigma involved. So in short, in answer to your question, Michael, what happened is a very, very powerful cultural as well as political backlash against the right to an abortion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
But let me just say, and I should turn it over to David, we now are having a backlash to the backlash. We are now having a reproductive justice movement asserting itself, and I'll let David take that one.
Mm-hmm. And just as someone was just pointing out to me, we also have, in the midst of all that, we also have the Democrats with their safe, legal, and rare, which is opening up a whole other gate to exactly what you're talking about.
Well, that was an unfortunate way to express it in the 90s, because it further stigmatized the idea that people who need abortions are doing something that really shouldn't happen. But I think we've seen a bit of a change in the past few years, especially as the reproductive justice movement has taken more hold. But we've seen some progressive state and city legislators really try to reduce barriers to access in important ways. And it's been really around the country. We've seen some really stunning wins, along with some losses, but some wins in places like New York City and Maine and California and Oregon and Illinois and even Kansas, around abortion access. So there's reason for encouragement.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, David, and I'll I'll be switching back to you very soon too, Carol. But you know, what is it that, you know, just thinking about this, why is it such a huge challenge, do you think, to guarantee women the right to abortion, the right to control their body when they decide that this is what they need to do? Why do you guys think that this is such a huge challenge in the society today?
I mean, to me, I think it's rooted in gender stereotypes, wanting to make it difficult for women to participate fully in society and control their own reproduction, and this very old-fashioned view of what the nuclear family should be, and that we should all be in one with a woman who's been pregnant and had kids and not out there working and taking her place in society and controlling her life. So I really think it goes down to this basic sort of disrespect and even hatred of women and their participation in society.
Carol, did you want to comment on anything?
Yes, I do. Very much agree with what David said. I would additionally add that although initially the Republican Party, being a quote conservative party, being not interested in government regulation of people's private lives, initially the Republicans were more pro-choice, actually, than the Democrats. That gradually changed. That changed dramatically starting in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan, with the growth of the moral majority, and especially with the Catholic Church and the evangelicals joining forces. And so basically what happened is that anti-abortion became a central pillar of the Republican Party, and I don't think we can overestimate that enough. In other words, you cannot run for office as a president, as a senator, as a congressperson, as a Republican if you are not anti-abortion. And so much of the restrictions we've seen, and the worst happened. I mean, the biggest assault on abortion occurred after the 2010 midterm elections, where Republicans swept state legislators and governorships. And then we saw restriction after restriction after restriction. So in terms of understanding why we are where we are, David is absolutely right. Deep, profound cultural resentment of women's autonomy, but also the political payoff for the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I would throw in there too, very 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 seriously, the fact that what they're talking about is actually what's the proper place for women. You know, it's sort of in society, which is basically is the dehumanization of women, reducing women to sexual toys for men or childbearing creatures that will drop their kid and then bring on more. You know, this is the kind of situation that we're living in today. And I think when you look at this, even the difficulty people have finding a clinic today, and I was talking to somebody about that earlier, and they said to me, well, you remember there was a period where you could actually find clinics a lot easier than you can today because people are actually, and I said, oh, yeah, well, what's behind that? And she was saying, well, look, part of it is a lot of these clinics are every day surrounded with chaos and the kinds of things that are happening there that, there's all kinds of stuff that's going on where people, the wackos are out there talking about how, they're going to stop it. There's threats on people's lives and on that. And, the anti-abortion movement has actually been part of killing of people, which is people that have been involved in that movement have gone out and done some pretty heinous things. And I think it's really, you think about this, the difficulty women have of finding a clinic these days, because it is very difficult. People were telling me that early on, that it's a very difficult thing to actually just, you can't just walk down the street and, oh yeah, there's the guy, there's the doctor, there's the doctor that hangs out the shingle and we can go in there and take care of it. You have chaos outside the clinics. Basically, the fascistic forces come and think that, who are trying to keep women in their places, where they set up government-mandated counseling at clinics that actually is trying to convince women that they're making a mistake and that it's going to be the worst thing they could ever do. You're giving away God's present to you, all this stuff. It's really a horror here. So let's talk about that a little bit, because I think there's something people have to understand about. In a certain sense, there is a warlike atmosphere going on, and one side is out full force, and people are struggling. I think the other side are the people who actually care about women, who view women as actual human beings, and are actually siding with that. And there's a lot going on both of those sides. And I'd like to hear a little bit in particular about the side that's actually saying, look, we cannot allow this to continue.
Yeah, I think the issue of finding clinics is two things. One, there have been a lot of clinic closures because of state overregulation of abortion clinics, with the intent to shut them down. These are called trap laws, targeted regulations of abortion providers, and they make it really expensive, almost impossible, to operate an abortion clinic. And there's a case before the Supreme Court right now that's considering one such law in Louisiana that would shut down all but one clinic in the state, although the state's done a pretty good job over the past couple decades. There are only three clinics right now in the entire state. So that's one of the big hurdles, and we talk about that a lot in our book. But the other thing you point out is the chaos in front of clinics, because abortion protesters have been allowed to set up shop in front of clinics and harass patients, harass providers, and do everything from follow them into clinics to yell at them to sometimes physically get in front of them and make it difficult for them to get by. And so even for a patient who finds a clinic, gets to the clinic, it's really difficult getting into the clinic because of the harassment and obstruction of anti-abortion extremists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but if I may, Michael, I would like to also talk about the resistance.
Yes.
I mean, the resistance from, quote, our side, because what David and I found out during, doing these interviews, and I should say we interviewed more than 70 people in every state in this country, and what we found out is just the incredible dedication of not only the abortion providers themselves, but of a huge, huge army of clinic defenders, people who escort, people who go to clinics, help the very frightened people coming to the clinic, you know, to get them through the howling mobs, people who drive. We heard incredible stories of volunteers who drive often very long distances to get women to the clinics if the women don't have a car. One of the most extraordinary, unbelievable stories we heard was a woman in the South who literally drove a patient from the South where she was too sick to be seen at that state's one clinic. She first drove her to Washington, D.C. Then that the clinic in D.C. couldn't take care of her. She then drove her to New York where she finally was taken care of. Then she drove her home back to the South, a 12-hour drive through a blinding rainstorm. I mean, this story is off the charts, but it gives you a sense of, you know, of the army of resistors out there who are dedicated to helping people get to the abortions they need. It's deeply, deeply moving.
Absolutely, and I'm really glad you brought that up. And I we're going to have to move on, but I wanted to actually raise this again, that you folks are already in the piece that you wrote in your book. You've argued that we're already in a post-Roe world, and I think what you're saying is really important, both of you, and I think also what you've just brought up now in terms of there are very dedicated, very courageous people who literally take their lives in their hands by going out and standing up and saying, no, we're not going to allow this to continue. It's a dedicated army of people that want to protect what should be a human right for women. Without them, the legal right of the 1 million women who want an abortion each year would be meaningless. And actually, to a certain extent, anybody who claims to actually be even have a grain of you know, whatever progressiveness in their body, in their head, if you cannot get behind understanding why this is so important, and it's not giving something to women, it's actually demanding that women be treated with all the rights of all other human beings, okay? And that's and that would be the all other would be men, okay, who seem to claim everything. So at any rate, I don't know, we have to move on quick, but I really want to have you guys back on to talk to get a little bit deeper into this, because there's so much in your book, and I think it's really well worth it, folks. It's really, you'll pick it up, you'll learn a hell of a lot, your eyes will be in a whole different place, your understanding will be in a whole different place after you read this. So real quick, if David, do you have something you want to end up with?
I mean, I think that voting doesn't solve anything, but the one thing we tell it doesn't solve everything, but the one thing we tell everyone, if you care about these issues, you have to elect pro-choice candidates at every level of government, local, state, and national, because that's where we see the difference. When we get pro-choice candidates in office, supported by mass movements, they can actually make changes for people.
Although I tell you, David, on my end of things, I'd really just like to see some kick butt stuff get out there where people say, no way, to hell with what you're saying, you're not going there, okay?
Right.
So that's, you know, to me, that's going to be more effective. anyway, did you want to wrap up with anything, Carol?
I want to endorse both of you. They absolutely right. Elections have huge consequences. We saw this in 2018. Thousands of women are now going to get abortions that they probably wouldn't have gotten had there not been elected Democratic governors in a number of states. And, Michael, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by kicking butt, but if you mean people need to go to clinics and help women get in the doors and stand up to the bullies who are out there screaming at them, I agree with you as well.
Exactly. And what I'm saying, too, is that we cannot allow this other example of the consolidation of fascism on a little bit different level than the rest of society, but really part of it. And I think this, in terms of what's being done to women, it's heinous, it's unacceptable, And I really think that people, you know, we need to talk about what people need to do too. You know, people themselves in terms of standing up and, and not bowing their heads to, and looking the other way. So I want to thank you both very much for joining us today. And I'm going to say real quick, the book is Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggle to Get an Abortion in America. And it's by David S. Cohen and Carol Jaffe. And I've just really enjoyed talking with you. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk again soon.
Okay. Thank you
very much.
You're welcome. Take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're going to take a quick break as we bring in our last guest. It's going to be very exciting, all right? So stay tuned. See, I was just waiting for those horns to come in, Teddy. See? I knew you. See, you know me, man. There you go. All right, welcome back. And you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show. And today, we're moving into a whole new section of the program, which I think is actually, I went to see this play, okay? I'm just going to get right down to it. People know, if you listen to the show regularly, I love the Fountain Theater. I love the people that work in it, the people that make their appearances in it, and I'm never left hungry. I want more, but I'm not hungry. And because I've actually learned something and I've seen something and I've, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've wrestled with friends about, you know, what was produced in on the stage at the Fountain Theater. And don't always agree with everything, all right? I just want you to get clear on that. But it opens my head up, and it's really important. And I think this is actually some of what happened recently, because I recently went to see a show that, well, it's called Human Interest Story. And when I first saw the title, I thought, all right, what are you doing to me, man? And, you know, I realized, we got to see this. This is actually a remarkable play. And we went and saw it, and I was floored. And I'm really pleased to welcome to the station, to the show, Stephen Sachs, who's been here, this is about your 1,000th visit, right?
I think so, yeah.
We're going to have a cake afterwards, right? Yeah. Although I'll probably eat it all. And the name of it is Human Interest Story, and Stephen is, you're actually what? You're the... What's your role?
I'm the playwright and the director.
The director, too.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. The playwright and the director.
That's
me. New playwright.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then we're also joined by, now it's Tanya, you said?
Tanya yes.
Alexander. You do that just to mess me up, right? Okay, and she plays a very powerful role in this play, and she'll talk about it a little bit later. And Rob Nagel.
Hello there.
Hi.
Good morning. Good to see you again.
You know you're suspect, man. I had a friend that was named Nagel.
Did you?
Yeah, and he ran away, and I never saw him again. Is that you?
It's probably my cousin, or my dad's cousin, or my brother, my long lost brother.
Well,
good to see you again.
Let's jump into this because we're going to take this on. This is, folks, the play is a really great play, and you're going to try and mount it again sometime in the future.
Yes, like every other theater in Los Angeles, have been forced to suspend our run with the hope that at some point soon we'll be able to resume the run and continue presenting the play.
Yeah, and that's really important because it's, you know, when people, just out of curiosity, just because I don't quite understand, is it because they didn't want people, was it that they don't want to have the possibility of infection coming?
Yes. Yeah. Both the governor and Mayor Garcetti have issued mandates that groups of 50 or less cannot gather together in one place, and they are advising against social intimacy and promoting social distancing. And social distance is not what we're about at the Fountain Theater. It's the opposite of who we are. We're all about intimacy. So like so many other intimate theaters in LA, we've been forced to go on hiatus.
You guys want to have anything to say about that? No.
I think it's a necessary decision in the current time. We're sad to not be able to tell the story every weekend, but we're hopeful that we'll be able to come back and do it again. What do you think, Tanya?
Yeah, definitely. I understand. I mean, you're in close proximity. This is early on in this virus thing, so we want to make sure that everybody's safe. So, you know, if people can't be far apart from each other or have the choice to sit 6 feet or 10 feet away from someone else, I kind of understand that. But definitely putting it back up and continuing the run is on our radar.
You know, one of the things that gets to me, though, is that, and look, I think that one of the things about this play that is really important is it really establishes something. And I was thinking about this in relation to basically to your characters in the play, but also to what's happening in society. And, you know, one of the things when you're looking at now that, okay, everybody has been talking about it, all of us here have been talking about it, where we've sort of been given the mandate, you don't do this, you don't do that, you know, and there's a lot of stuff I'm very nervous about, you, them telling us we don't do this and we don't do that. And, you know, you're wondering, you're sitting back and you're thinking, okay, now who's pushing the buttons up around here and where are they going to eventually end up? You know, and I was driving down Hollywood Boulevard the other day and I saw these homeless people that I see most of the time. But, you know, they're looking more raggedy than they were. They're cold, they're standing out. And I keep thinking about, okay, what are we looking at? Like, where does this go? Because there's not really, you know, what do we do with the people who are suffering the most in society? And that's because that's something actually that your play was about. You know, you had people, you had someone who was suffering the most, and then you had somebody who said, you know, got hit hard by your job, but then you also sort of worked into, you know, okay, how are you going to work this out and make this? And you'd started out doing it in a real good way. And I'm not going to tell people all the the things, but you know, there were big questions that were posed there. And those same questions that hit me, and this is why I was saying, Stephen, it hit me because we're confronted with the need to actually deal with the fact that there are a lot of people out here who are going to get sick. I mean, I see it in my neighborhood. There are people going to get sick, you know, easily. A lot of immigrants, you know, they're going to get sick. You know, people who don't have any money, people who can't go to a doctor. You know, what happens? And then the thing of, this is a pretty hard deal in time, because you have to be very, I think there's a need for people to be assertive, you know, in, go ahead.
Well, absolutely. I completely agree with you. Yes, Human Interest Story is a new play that interweaves all these very urgent issues through storylines of human beings. And we're able to dramatize several important issues that we are facing right now: homelessness, truth in journalism, greed, politics. And not only is the homeless issue that is dramatized in the play, of course, at the forefront of our minds and important. It also, as I think about the play too, the idea of truth and who tells it. There's a character in the play that is sort of a Roger Ailes character, played by Jim Harper. And he has this, he's a media mogul, and he has this scene with Tanya, which maybe she can speak about as well, where she tells him that the truth is whatever we say it is, and how that 6 corporations controlled 90% of the media in this country, and that 15 billionaires control every major newspaper in this country. And these ideas, these truths, have really been resonating with me the last few weeks when we hear from our government untruths and the spinning of lies, and how members of the current administration are in their own delusional world of what they want us to think is true, and it's just not so.
Mm-hmm. Tanya,
yes.
Did you have something to say about that?
In that scene in particular, where the Harold Kane character speaks with Jane Doe, who's my character, and tells her how America works, it's one of the most powerful moments. It's my favorite monologue, actually, even though some of the things he's saying is just, some people would find it despicable, and they just, you know, just the way that he goes about letting her know unapologetically that this is who controls the narrative in this country, who controls the truth, what they hear, the information. But it's one of those eye-opening moments where people get a certain viewpoint that's so unapologetic and true that you have to think about it. You have to, you know, now it's like, oh, wow. And it's delivered in such a way, it's his complete belief that, you know, this is my station and that's your station, you know. And I think that's in the play in general. Everybody has their agenda and their story, and not one point of view is heavier than another, but every point of view is seen. And so the audience isn't hit over the head with one particular agenda. I think they get to see it all in these personal stories and decide, you know, whoever side they want to be on or who they want to listen to and that kind of thing. So it's pretty interesting.
But I have to tell you, the people that sided on the wrong side, I just wanted to spit on them. It's
like, but you can't. You can't spit on them now. You have to wait to do that later.
Look, I got this. All right.
Oh, man, yeah.
Rob, what about you in relation to this? Because it's, you know, because your character actually is a very, very interesting character. And I was thinking about that even in relation to, look, part of what we have to do today, I think, you know, we have the theater, we have the art that actually can bring people, you know, into a scene. But we have to, basically, we have the duty, in a certain sense, I hate using that word, but we have a duty to actually go out and look, there's a whole grouping of people who are probably going to suffer the most in relation to what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we actually stand with them? And I think that's one thing that your character, you know, Rob, was actually trying to get in deep to.
Yes.
You know, and there was a fight to get there for everybody. And I think you probably had that, you know, when you wrote it, you were probably looking at it like, what the hell, man? This is, but there actually is something, and it's very pressing now, because how do we look at the people that are suffering in society, and how do we look at the people that, I mean, I have been told, you know, my wife is Chinese, I've been told, you don't, you know, what are the Chinese, you know, they're responsible for this,
mm-hmm.
you know, or they look at the immigrants that live across the street, and they're mm-hmm. carrying disease.
It's mm-hmm. a foreign virus.
Yeah, and what is that going to happen, what's going to happen here? And see, in that way, it's what you were dealing with in your character in the play.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. He's a, you know, he's a very popular columnist at the paper in the city. He's been trying to use his column as a platform to give a voice to those who don't have a voice. He's trying to use his place in a system in order to promote change and change for the good. And he sees the homeless issue, as one he's written on a number of times, as the current epidemic. Now we've got another one, a pandemic. But for him, he's trying to use that position of journalistic integrity and trying to tell the truth and tell stories about people who are human beings. We're all very good at looking away from the ugliness around us. We're very good at going under the overpass and seeing the encampment that is, you know, 16% larger than it was 2 years ago, because that's how quickly it's growing. And we're able to walk away or drive away and not think about it for another few minutes or days. And the fact is, these are people who are not only cold and alone, but in some cases dying and unhealthy and in need of help. And for a Judeo-Christian society like we are, to come into the world and not pay attention to those people who are less fortunate really bristles Andy Kramer's spine in the play, and bristles my play, probably bristles my spine. We're all trying to make a change, but we need to fight harder for the people who can't get the help on their own.
And that's going to be very important in relation to what is shaping up now, because, you know, I mean, what I was saying is, like, look, people, you know that there are people, and there are very backward-thinking people who would be driving down the street and see some homeless people sitting in the cardboard box, and they've done it when nothing was at stake before. You know, people have set homeless people on fire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this whole question of how do we actually look at what we can do in terms of, you know, one, I can't wait. And this, when you get the clearance to actually have this play, got to come back. We got to have the play. You got to have full on getting people out there, because it's just that important.
Yep.
It makes people question, what the hell are we doing in the face of a horror that we've let loose in society? And I think that's, maybe we can talk, each one can have something, because we're running out. Mm-hmm. But I wish we had more time.
Yes.
Stephen, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, listening to Rob, add too that Rob's character, Andy, the journalist, has all of these good intentions and a platform that to do good things. And he's thrown into a moral and ethical crisis because he loses his job and sort of does a dance with the devil and makes the decision to spread an untruth for the sake of what he feels is right mm-hmm. and good. So there's a very interesting and complicated moral dilemma that Andy experiences that complicates him as a character. It's too easy for all of us to say we need to do good things.
Mm-hmm.
And Tanya, now they're closing us up, but I have to tell you, your character, you could have walked down the street with me anytime. I would do whatever, because I thought the integrity that was there.
Thank you.
All right, we got to wrap this up because everybody's going wild right now, and I wish we had more time to talk, but I'm really looking forward to when all this is over and this play is out there again and you guys are in there and hitting it hard. All right, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks.
Take care. Talk to you again next week.
Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. We just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Just let it be. Na, 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Need a little help. Say it, boy. Need some help, y'all. Change the world. What it used to be. Do it alone. Do it alone. Need some help, yeah. Need some help, yeah. Well, don't use up.